Ekatra Foundation presents the Ekatra Dialogue, an exploration of the world's greatest thinkers and ideas. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're looking at a source that, honestly, it reads less like a typical memoir and more like, well, a blueprint for total self-destruction and then this absolutely radical reinvention.
Yeah, we're diving into Lara Love Hardin's book, The Many Lives of Mama Love. And the subtitle really says it all. A memoir of lying, stealing, writing, and healing. It's quite a journey.
It really is. I mean, if you just look at snapshots of her life, it's almost unbelievable. You've got this suburban mom in Aptos, California, right?
Right.
Totally focused on keeping up this perfect image. She was even, get this, working as a pet psychic at one point.
Which is such a perfect detail, isn't it? It just screams performing perfection.
Exactly. But that perfection was hiding something much, much darker.
Oh, completely. Beneath that surface, she was spiraling. And that's why this deep dive feels so necessary, I think. Because that image shattered into, well, heroin addiction, a really sophisticated identity theft scheme.
Stealing from her neighbors.
From her own neighbors, yeah. And it all ended with this dramatic arrest, 32 felony counts.
32, wow. So she went from, what, PTA meetings to a jail cell?
Pretty much. So our mission today is really to trace that path. How did she fall so far? What was going on psychologically? And then crucially, how did she manage to completely rewrite her life?
Yeah, how do you go from felon to a four-time New York Times bestselling ghostwriter and co-founder of a major literary agency, working with people like the Dalai Lama?
It's an incredible arc. We need to figure out what changed inside her. How did she turn that deep shame, which could have destroyed her, into, well, her greatest strength?
Okay, so to understand the fall, we need to start with that pressure cooker life she built, the Gilded Cage, the book calls it.
Yeah, the Gilded Cage. She was incredibly good at curating this image of flawlessness. Husband, kids, beautiful house, the whole checklist.
But that created this intense fear of failure, right? Imposter syndrome.
Absolutely. Huge imposter syndrome. And the terrible irony is that the very perfection she chased made her feel trapped, utterly trapped. It created this massive internal void, just this aching emptiness inside.
And something stepped in to fill that void, something clinical.
Yes. The catalyst, the inciting incident, really, was a Vicodin prescription after the birth of her fourth child.
Okay, so let's slow down here, because this wasn't just about physical pain.
Not at all. For someone constantly battling that feeling of inadequacy, you know, that voice saying, you're not good enough, the opiate did something else.
What did she say it felt like?
She described it as a warm, numbing blanket of confidence. Suddenly, that inner critic just went silent.
Wow.
And that chemical escape, that silencing, that became addictive way before any major physical dependency kicked in. It was the mental relief she craved.
But the physical side does catch up, doesn't it? And the need escalates.
Brutally. It escalated quickly from the pills to a full-blown heroin addiction. We're talking hundreds of dollars a day.
Which is where the crime comes in. You can't sustain that kind of habit legally.
Exactly. And this wasn't like shoplifting a candy bar. She became this really organized identity thief, stealing mail, checks, credit cards.
From her neighbors, the people living right next door.
Yes. And what's just fascinating and frankly terrifying is how she managed it psychologically, the compartmentalization involved.
Right. She invented that persona, the neighbor.
The neighbor.
Yeah.
She mentally outsourced all the criminal stuff to this, like, fictional alter ego.
So the perfect mom could keep functioning.
Pretty much. Keep going to PTA meetings, school pickups, all while the neighbor was busy forging checks. It's this incredible example of dissociation under immense pressure.
But that kind of double life, it can't last forever.
No. Inevitably, it all came crashing down. The climax was that arrest. Very public, right there at her perfect suburban home.
All the secrets, all the lies just blown wide open.
Completely. Charged with 32 felonies. It was the total utter annihilation of that carefully constructed identity. There was nowhere left to hide.
So she hits rock bottom, stripped of everything. She enters Santa Cruz County Jail, and she's just an inmate number, W-13374.
Yeah, dehumanizing. But it's right there, in that absolute darkness, that something unexpected happens, a flicker of something else.
The nickname.
The nickname, Mama Love. Mm. Given to her by the other inmates. And the sources are really clear on this. It wasn't sarcastic.
No.
No, it wasn't about her crimes. It was because even in jail, her sort of maternal caring nature came through.
Wow. So it was like a tiny piece of her true self being seen even then.
Exactly. Like a lifeline. Someone seeing value in her beyond the inmate number, beyond the felonies.
But getting out of jail, that wasn't the end of the struggle, was it?
Oh, not even close. She then slammed right into what she calls the paper prison.
The paper prison. Explain that.
It's the reality for so many formerly incarcerated people. You're technically free, but your felony record makes it almost impossible to find housing, find a decent job.
The background check is just a constant wall.
A constant wall. And she talks about being haunted by shame. She calls it the ghost, this constant whisper of failure, of being worthless.
That sounds incredibly difficult. So how did she break through that? Did she just keep applying for jobs?
She tried everything, but nothing worked. The breakthrough was almost accidental. She landed this really menial part-time unpaid internship.
Unpaid.
Unpaid at Idea Architects, the literary agency. Yeah. She literally started by taking out the trash.
Taking out the trash, seriously.
Seriously. And terrified the whole time that someone would find out about her past and everything would collapse again.
But clearly it didn't. Her talent must have shone through.
It did. And this is the really unbelievable part of the story. She climbs the ranks from intern taking out the trash to literary agent and eventually co-founder and president of the agency.
Working with icons like Archbishop Desmond Tutu and the Dalai Lama.
Exactly. But you mentioned earlier the title wasn't the real validation for her.
Right. What was?
The real turning point, the moment she felt truly free, was when she finally confronted that ghost.
Hmm.
She confessed everything, her entire past, every crime, every lie to the founder, Doug Abrams.
That must have taken incredible courage. I mean, she could have lost everything right there.
Absolutely terrifying. But his response, that was the key.
What did he do?
He responded with compassion, not judgment, just unwavering support. And in that moment, she said, the ghost just vanished. She realized shame loses its power when it's spoken and met with empathy.
Wow, that's powerful.
And you see the culmination of this journey in her work, right?
Mm-hmm.
The woman who stole identities, who betrayed trust on such a fundamental level.
Ends up co-authoring the Book of Forgiving with Desmond Tutu.
Yeah, and Nobel Peace Prize laureate. I mean, the symbolism there is just profound. It speaks volumes about the possibility of transformation.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so if we look at how she rebuilt herself, what were the underlying principles? What drove that transformation?
Well, the memoir sort of crystallizes it into three core philosophical pillars that guided her recovery. The first one is just radical accountability.
Meaning
taking complete, unvarnished ownership, no excuses. She looked at the root causes, the addiction, the psychological pain, sure. But she never used them to excuse the harm she caused.
So it was about making amends, not finding reasons why it wasn't really her fault?
Exactly. Rejecting the victim narrative entirely.
Mm.
The second pillar seems to have come from her time inside, which is compassionate curiosity.
Curiosity about?
About herself and about others, especially the women she was incarcerated with. Moving away from just judging people, including herself, and instead getting curious about their stories. What led them here? What pain are they carrying?
Seeing the person behind the label.
Right. And that leads directly to the third pillar, the rejection of throwaway people.
Which sounds like
a deep belief that nobody is defined forever by their worst mistake. That everyone has inherent value, regardless of what they've done. That nickname, Mama Love, became the proof of that for her. Her advocacy now is really built on that foundation.
Okay, that framework makes sense. So to help everyone listening really grasp the arc, let's pinpoint three absolutely pivotal moments, three turning points that fundamentally shifted her trajectory.
Okay. The first one takes us back to the very beginning of the downward slide, the first Vicodin prescription.
Right. Not just a medical event.
No. It was the psychological relief it offered.
Yeah.
That warm, numbing blanket that silenced the inner critic. It rewired something in her brain, offered this incredibly seductive escape route from her feelings of inadequacy, and that put her on the path to catastrophe.
Okay. Turning point two is much more dramatic. The arrest?
Yeah, the police cars swarming her perfect house.
Yeah.
This was the moment this facade just detonated publicly.
The complete implosion of the fake identity.
Total annihilation. It forced her into this absolute rock bottom. But from that rock bottom, maybe authentic rebirth was the only way out. There was nothing left to pretend about.
And the third turning point is quieter, but maybe just as powerful.
I think so. It's being named Mama Love.
In jail. By the other inmates.
Yeah. Think about it. The state labels you inmate W13374, dehumanized. And then your peers, the other women sharing this awful experience, they see something else. They see your inherent nature.
Mama Love.
Mama Love.
Yeah.
This profound affirmation of worth right there in the darkest place, it gave her a new positive identity to maybe, possibly live into, and show that connection and empathy can survive even the harshest judgment.
So, looking at this whole story, the perfectionism, the fall, the shame, the rebuilding, what are the big human lessons here for us, for you listening? We're talking about the ghost of shame.
Right. And the key lesson, I think, is how she ultimately dealt with that ghost. For years, she tried to outrun it, right? Hide it.
Which just fuels the anxiety, the imposter feeling.
Exactly. The shift came when she stopped running and chose to integrate it. To accept that, yes, she did these terrible things. They are part of her story. But they don't have to define her entire story.
And by owning it, integrating it.
Her wounds, her mistakes, actually became the source of her greatest strengths. Empathy, insight, understanding. Her advocacy work comes directly from that integrated past. It proves that authenticity, even when it's messy and painful, is so much more liberating than trying to maintain some impossible prison of perfection.
That's a really powerful takeaway. Okay, let's try and distill this even further. For you listening, here are three essential takeaways from our deep dive into the many lives of Mama Love.
Let's start with an emotional insight, and that is the liberation of confession.
Yeah. What her story shows so clearly is that shame thrives in secrecy. It can't survive being spoken out loud, especially when met with compassion. True freedom, that release she felt when she told her boss everything, comes from facing that shame-filled past self honestly. Vulnerability over secrecy.
Okay, next, an intellectual insight. The paper prison.
This is crucial. Her struggle highlights the very real systemic barriers that ex-offenders face. Those felony records, the background checks. They create this paper prison that traps millions and prevents successful re-entry into society.
And her eventual success, against those odds, really challenges how we think about things like hiring. It makes a powerful case for second chances, showing that incredible resilience and talent can be found where we least expect it.
Definitely food for thought there. And finally, a universal insight. Define your own legacy.
This is maybe the most fundamental message. You are not the sum of your worst choices. Your identity isn't permanently fixed at your lowest point.
She took all that negative energy, the betrayal, the crime, the shame, and consciously transformed it into positive action, into advocacy.
Exactly. It shows that adversity, even self-inflicted adversity, can be the raw material for building a much deeper, more meaningful, and purposeful life. You get to write the later chapters.
A powerful message of hope, really.
It is. But let's leave you with one final thought. Laura Loveharden was, by her own admission, the neighbor from hell. She systematically violated the trust of her community. Her life now forces us to ask, who in our own communities, maybe even in our own histories, have we written off as unforgivable? What are the limits of our own compassion when people fail, even fail spectacularly, but then genuinely seek to rebuild and contribute? Where do we draw that line?
That's a deeply challenging question to sit with. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into a truly unforgettable story of falling apart and putting oneself back together. Join us next time for a new episode featuring another world-renowned individual, a new book, and a new idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.